Not long ago, I came across a student who openly admitted to using generative AI in completing their assignment, simply because everyone is doing the same. It made me pause, not to judge them, but to ask, what does this mean for the way we measure learning and uphold academic integrity? How do we design assessments that still matter when AI is part of the picture? Today, I am joined by someone who has been in the forefront of the conversation. Welcome to Dare to Disrupt, the podcast where we unpack the biggest shift in education technology and AI, one conversation at a time. I am Derek Piton, and today we are asking how AI is challenging the way we design assessment and protecting academic integrity. Joining me today is Dr. Asim Bashir, someone who has been in the forefront of the conversation. I could list all your achievements. However, I would like you to introduce yourself to our listeners by yourself.
Thanks for inviting me today on your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. I am currently an assessment coordinator and EAP lecturer at a British university in the Bay. I've been here for approximately 3 years. Previously, I've worked in the UK and Saudi Arabia at universities and various institutes there. Currently, as the assessment coordinator, my main role is developing and arranging for the delivery of assessments, which in the current climate has been more challenging than in previous years.
By saying more challenging, do you mean by the emergence of AI?
Yeah, of course. I think one thing that we higher education institutes typically are quite static, and that's not because of the lack of desire to change. It's due to how difficult and how regulated things are. For example, to change something, you can't just change something because it's something that you feel like doing. There's a process, and that process can be quite lengthy. So minor changes sometimes also take quite some time, but major changes, for example, the changes that we currently need to go through right now, take longer than people think. It's not a matter of just developing and designing a new curriculum over the summer. These things take 1 or 2 years. So I think so. Although it is from perceived that higher education take time to adapt,
exactly,
or to change.
Right.
However, I don't think that's because of the lack of desire to do so. It's just because of how things are regulated. So maybe that's something that we need to think about, how we can change regulations. However, if we lose those regulations, we may lose quality,
right,
and standards. So that's something that needs to be considered.
And I really like the fact that you mentioned the aspect of, you know, being perceived as higher education is slow. And I think it's I've heard that conversation a lot, that people say when it comes to, you know, integrating technology, for example, into teaching and learning, higher education is slower compared to K-12, for example. And I like the fact that you've mentioned that it takes time to develop policy and all of that. But do you think it could actually be faster if we actually want to do that?
I believe so. But however, I think these kinds of decisions need to be made from the regulatory bodies.
Right.
And I think they need to be the first ones to understand the climate that we're in and allow for changes to be made at a quicker pace when we're faced with something as precedent as AI's emergence or ChatGPT, whichever version we're on right now. So I think if the regulatory bodies are still requiring the same things or have the same requirements from universities, then this can be challenging if they are not recognizing the need for quick-paced change.
I mean, much of your career, you've supported students in their academic skills and writing skills as well. How would you say AI is changing that perspective of education?
I think students are able to lean on AI, some more than others, and some are becoming, I mean, there are various elements or various degrees of reliance and use of AI, which we can maybe mention later in the discussion. But to directly answer this question, I think it's become easier for students to do certain tasks. and students know exactly what those tasks are.
Right.
And I think it's very important for educators to also understand what are those tasks that students can now do very easily with AI. And then the decisions about whether they want them to be permitted or how much AI is able to be used. I mean, those are decisions to be made depending on what you are trying to learn or teach. But to directly answer the question about how we've seen it change or have we seen it change, yes. And I can give you a quick example. A conversation I had with a recent colleague who is still teaching, who's still assessing in some of the ways they were assessing a few years ago, said that I've noticed vast improvements in the quality of students' writing. In fact, the entire cohort's quality of writing has gone up several degrees. So my immediate question was that because of AI? Right. And he said, yeah, of course. So then my question was, so then what? I mean, is your assessment going to stay the same? What are you actually assessing? And then there was a slight pause, and he said, well, for now, we're just leaving it as it is. And for me, that's not acceptable. When you can see that the quality of writing has improved, then it means that maybe you should be assessing something else.
You should be testing critical thinking.
Yeah, so educators need to see what exactly does AI do to assist the student, right. And do we really need to assess it?
Right.
And if you don't need to assess it, then just change what the assessment is actually doing. I think we shouldn't be afraid of changing our assessments and understanding what AI can do for students, because we use it the same. We use it to speed up our tasks.
Exactly.
And so I think we need to understand exactly what elements of an assessment or what elements of students' learning can be sped up, and use that to our advantage, but assess something else.
I think that's a very good point by, you know, trying to see that what exactly are we accessing. And I would like to know, is this similar in non-English speaker as well? The usage? Have you noticed similarity in?
I have noticed differences in TEFL and ESOL learners. Previously as a manager of an ESOL program, I can tell you that they are at a massive advantage with the introduction of AI. And that's because it's almost like having a personalized tutor with them 24 hours a day. And that's the kind of guidance and structure and support that those kind of learners need. And it's at the very basic level of language. And so that's something that AI is very good at doing.
Well, if you look at the assessment side of things, AI has been recorded to be biased to international students sometimes when assessing them. So it has been recorded that some non-English speakers have been falsely accused of the usage of generative AI. How would you respond to that?
So I've worked also as an academic integrity officer for a few years. And this is something that has come up, right, in cases where non-native English speakers seem to be flagged more for the use of generative AI. Now, I think there needs to be clarity between generative AI and AI in general.
Right.
And I think sometimes that's where the lack of clarity here sometimes leads to problems. For example, tools that have been around for a long time are AI. For example, Google Translate or Grammarly, and these are probably the most two popular, and there are others. And in other markets and in other regions, there are other more popular ones which students use. But these are, in essence, AI translators.
Right.
So I think the software that has been developed, and this is what I came across and why some of these tools have not been adopted by major institutes, including our own, why tools which were so-called detecting the use of AI,
right,
were seen to have this bias in them.
The AI detectors.
Yes, the AI detectors were seen to have the bias in them, particularly flagging those whose English was not their first language.
Right.
And so they have a declaration on there,
right,
which says that the results may not be 100% accurate.
Okay.
So they themselves know that this can lead to what they call false positives. And then also now AI, there are AI tools that have been developed specifically to avoid detection.
To humanize it.
to humanize. And I think there are so many popular ones out there which can be. So I think knowing that these exist again,
right,
if we are looking purely at language and quality of language, well, we know AI can do that very quickly. So something that I think we need to consider, and something that I like to think that we do at our institute, is to think about what exactly are you assessing and what are the ways that you can assess it. Is it just in this one particular way? And that's not to say that certain assessments need to be thrown out. For example, the traditional essay of 2,000 words or 1,500 words or 5,000 words, whatever it is. It's not necessary to say that these assessments are outdated because they can be changed. If you are insisting on testing students' quality of writing and it's an important part of your learning outcomes of your course, then you should test the quality of their writing maybe in a controlled environment where AI is not going to be able to be used, rather than allowing students to submit something from home where they have the ability to use AI, and we know that, and then telling them, but you can't use AI.
Yeah.
And I think this is the wrong approach. So I think we need to see exactly what we want to test in each assessment and then make sure that the environment that we create in that assessment matches what we are actually testing.
In my conversation with a professor, she mentioned that it's a painful experience spending hours on marking scripts that you know that students have actually used 5 minutes in generating. How do you see that?
Well, my immediate reaction is that you are assessing the wrong thing. If you are trying to assess language and you know that that language can be produced within 5 minutes, then it shouldn't matter how good the language is. You should be assessing something else. And I think you previously mentioned critical thinking.
Yeah.
Now, I think what's becoming more apparent now are the skills that need to be tested and are more, I like to say, rather than saying AI resilient, but maybe more, will be more desired for the future. I don't like the word AI proof because I think it means that we're trying to combat AI.
Right, which we are not.
And I think we need to embrace AI and just assess other things. Right. We don't need to make things AI proof.
Right.
We just need to know what skills we're assessing.
Yeah.
And some of the skills naturally are resilient to AI. For example, critical thinking. For example, reflective practice.
Right.
These things require, and some of the other higher order thinking skills, they require you to use more brain power.
Exactly.
And you can't just use AI to do those things for you because it needs to be deep within your soul and heart and deep within your mind, and it can never get there. And those are unique qualities of being human. And we can't replace those. I think no matter how far ahead we get with AI, AI can never be in your mind. You know exactly what's in your mind. So I think that human element will never be lost. So I think it's about testing and being able to test critical thinking, being able to see what the thought process, and the word process is important here. It's more about the process rather than the product. And I think traditionally assessments focus on product,
right,
because that's the end product and we want to be able to quantify.
So you're saying it's time to start shifting towards process.
Yeah, and I think we can break tasks down into various points of assessment, whether they are formative or summative. However, we need to be able to step back and look at how the students have gone through the process to be able to determine whether they are thinking critically. So for example, reflection is a good way of doing that. Have students reflect on the journey that they've been through. Now, only the student knows the journey that they've been through. Now, can a student use AI to do that? Of course they can. They can get the student to help them with the language, but they can't ask the AI to tell them what the journey they went through.
To reflect for them. Yeah.
Yes, because only they know what they felt at a certain period of time and what challenges they faced and what they felt, how AI assisted them. So there needs to be their own input. if AI was to generate maybe a reflective piece for them, they should read it and see, does this actually match what I went through in my journey? And if it didn't, at that point, they need to have their own input. And that's part of the process of using AI to help you, but not using AI to fully complete the task.
Exactly. And I like that you've mentioned that. And do you think it's important for assessor or professor, lecturer, so to speak, to declare to students saying, you can use AI to an extent for this assessment, or don't use it at all? I mean, by being transparent, being upfront with students, do you think it's time we start adopting such procedure?
So some of the research I have done and also read, the responses from students in particular on this aspect has been the lack of clarity and guidance.
Exactly.
And the overall opinion was, if there is no guidance on it, this means that it's permissible to use.
Right.
The default position from students,
exactly,
was that there were some who still were afraid to use it, basically maybe due to being falsely accused of cheating, for example.
Yeah.
But the majority felt that if there was no guidance restricting AI, then that meant that it was,
I can go ahead,
it was, they could use it as much as they wanted.
Yeah.
So there has been research done on AI guidance in assessment.
Right.
There is the traffic light system.
Traffic light system, which is a fantastic system.
Which is something that's been implemented by University of Leeds and I think a leading university in Australia. I think it was developed in Australia. And some institutes have adopted that. Now, that's something I was quite a fan of at the start, in particularly...
I've seen some K-12 schools as well. They've adopted traffic lights as well.
I think it's a good starting point. However, recently, I attended a conference recently where the presenter challenged the traffic light system. And now, he challenged it on the basis of, if you are not able to determine 100% how much AI has been used, then why are you setting limits? And let me kind of clarify what I mean. If you are saying something is amber, which yeah. means you can use AI to do to research, but you cannot use it to generate your text.
Yeah.
If you cannot determine whether or not a student has followed that, then you should not have those rules in place. So it made me question how useful, although it's useful to have some clarity, we are still depending on the student's declaration of their use of AI. And it's still, again, hard to determine or to prove otherwise. So
I think just to clarify the traffic system model for the listeners, it simply means green means you can use AI, amber means you can use it to an extent, and red means no, you can't use it at all. Yes. All right.
And there are some varying degrees between, and some of the traffic light systems have been expanded to 5 or 6 categories just because there's that much you can do with AI at the various levels.
Exactly.
However, I do believe that, so I'm more of a believer now that even though traffic light system is good for guidance, I think it's still difficult to hold students to account to something if you're not able to prove. How do you know if a student went from light green to dark green or went into amber? Is there something that you can quantify and be able to use as evidence or proof? And if not, then again, we are just going around in circles, and we rely on ethics.
I've never thought of the traffic light model in that perspective, but that's a very, very good perspective, because that's true. If you can't quantify, then what are you doing?
So hence why I said that we need to think about what we are assessing.
And coming back to what you mentioned about what exactly are we assessing. So my question would be to you that, what are the types of assessment that we should start looking into?
So I've mentioned some of them already, which people describe as AI proof, but I'd rather call them more assessments of the future rather than saying AI proof, because that makes us feel like, it makes it sound like we are fighting and combating AI.
Yeah.
So I think the assessments of the future are the ones that really test students' critical thinking, a student's ability to communicate, and ways we can do that are by having them present for example, is one way of
representation.
Because at the end of the day, even if you scripted something from AI,
yeah.
you would still have to. So when, for example, when we have students do presentations, we should almost immediately expect students to generate a script. But what we want to then see is maybe not the, the vocabulary that they use, but how they're able to convey the message.
Right.
How are they able to maintain eye contact with the listeners? Are they able to keep the listeners engaged?
Right.
Are they able to smoothly transition between sections? So these are the skills more we should be assessing in presentations rather than what kind of vocabulary and language is being used, because we know that that can be scripted from AI. So it's about maybe looking at different things, and maybe some of the assessments that we currently have can remain, but just what we assess in them might be different. So a reflection is another good one, and I think I mentioned it to you before about why a reflection for an assessment could work. A lot of institutes are also going on to oral assessments, for example Vivas now. A Viva is something that's typically used following a PhD,
but Viva is tricky when you have, you know, student number like 100 students. How do you want to, you know, conduct that?
So as I said, yeah, Viva was always seen as a good examination for a PhD thesis, and even after a master's dissertations, there are some institutes that will do the defense, they call it,
exactly,
and so it's something similar. So I think what started to happen in some of the undergraduate courses is a mini Viva, you could say, 10 to 15 minutes, which per student. Your point that you raised is absolutely valid. If you have 150 students, how do you conduct 150 Vivas?
Yeah.
It's also not fair, and in fact, it's against policy in most institutes to randomly select
the students.
Yeah, and say I want to do a Viva because I suspect something.
Exactly.
So it's either all or none. So it's not, as you said, as you've highlighted, it's probably not a feasible mode of assessment. However, it is valuable, because when you have, but you can do it informally even through a tutorial, and generally you have tutorials with your students throughout the year, and at any one of those points you could have a conversation with the student, and you'd quite quickly understand whether the student is engaged with the process or whether they're just relying on AI to just do the product. So it may not need to be in a summative Viva form, but I think the format is something that we can maybe play around with.
Should group work be considered as well in terms of helping them to develop their soft skills like collaboration and, you know, interpersonal skills as well?
I think I said communication was a key thing that we need to assess. Now group work is very good at assessing communication. It assesses both cognitive skills, listening and reading, listening and speaking. And it's something that is highly desirable in the workforce. These are some of the skills that companies are afraid of, or are afraid that students are going to lose because of the introduction of AI.
Exactly.
And they are referring to the soft skills that they need students to leave universities with at a minimum. Now, you mentioned group work. Now, if you think about almost every job that you've worked in, or every company you've worked in, or institute that you've worked in, regardless of the position, you always work individually and as a team, and you have to have the ability to communicate well within a group. So these are skills that will never be lost, regardless of the introduction of AI. It can improve us as a communicator. You could use AI as an assistant, for example, or somebody to communicate with. That's some way it can help you communicate. But it's not going to be there at the moment you're speaking in a group.
Right.
So I think we need to understand what the limitations of AI are, because there will be a point where AI, we've reached a peak of its assistance,
mm-hmm.
for example, at a basic level, human level, I mean.
Yeah.
And for example, when the internet was introduced, or Google search was introduced, it was a revelation.
Right.
but it became integrated in every part, in almost everything that we do. And we use it in all parts of our life. But we understand its limitations. We understand, for example, if we were to do a search in any search engine on the internet, we wouldn't just take the top search answer and just accept that that's the response.
Yeah.
We understand that we would have to keep scrolling and looking down and making our own judgments
exactly
on what seems reasonable or not. And so we may visit 10 or 20 different places to determine for ourselves what we accept as the truth. And it's the same for AI. AI can give you 10 or 20 different answers. So which one are we going to believe?
And I like that perspective, you know, in terms of looking, you know, making the judgment by yourself, being the human that is actually driving this kind of, you know, generative AI tools. And that brings us back to, you know, academics. We've spoken about students, and that brings us back to staff in terms of academics and how they are using generative AI as well. And your research is looking into the readiness of academics in the usage of generative AI. So what would you say is the gap in terms of capability and confidence?
I think based on my own research, it's confidence you've mentioned, and lack of clarity and lack of support.
Right.
As students are also unsure about how much AI they can use, staff are also unsure about how much AI they can introduce or have as part of their classroom and assessment, particularly the assessment. I think having AI as part of their teaching and the classroom, I think academics are more comfortable with bringing in AI, just as they have been with bringing in technology in the past.
Right.
However, it's the assessment part is where there's a lack of clarity. Should we permit students to use AI on assessments? And if we do, what does that mean for our assessments? Are we losing quality? So I think there needs to be clear guidelines,
right,
from senior management, from leadership, especially from regulatory bodies. They need to make it clear that by using AI or including AI in assessments, this is not diluting or weakening the assessments. And so I think once those guidelines are changed and we have the clarity, and I think then senior management then need to, and leadership need to ensure that staff are aware of these policies in place and guidelines and what they are allowed to do, then I think change can be done more confidently and also quickly.
And whilst we are waiting for policymakers and all of that, what can we do as an individual ourselves to start challenge the status quo and using the generative AI, and not because we can't wait forever, right? We have to start from somewhere. So what would you recommend that is a starting point for someone that has not been using this and they want to embrace it in their teaching and learning practice?
I think trial and error. See what works best for you in your context.
Okay.
And improve on that and build on that every year if you can. And then make sure you are sharing those practices.
Right.
I think one of the things which is more important now than ever is community of practice,
right,
is sharing of best practices across institutes. Institutes have their own way of doing things,
right,
and that's the way things are done. And what I've noticed even within institutes now, because of AI, some departments have advanced way more than others, and that's because they've been prepared to experiment.
Right.
And although guidelines have been a bit vague, they've taken bold steps to improve their assessments. Now, that doesn't mean everything that they've done has worked. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that year upon year, they are changing things because they're realizing that some things didn't work as well as they had hoped. But I think being brave and not being afraid to it's not, I wouldn't say, I like to say fail, but sometimes we feel that if something went slightly wrong with assessments, we failed the students. Actually, you fail the students if you do nothing.
Exactly.
And I think by doing something and by trying to enhance assessment, it's quite challenging. It's a lot of work.
But we have to start somewhere.
And I think the more we share best practices and share what works, a lot of the things I've done have not been because I had a dream about something working and then I just decided to do it tomorrow. It was because I've seen what others have done and I've read the research. I've attended conferences where they said, oh, we tried this and we've tried that. Excellent. Now, my mind might change year upon year based on my own experience and based on what I've seen happen and work for me in my context.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. So I think my overall message here is don't be afraid to try. And if something doesn't work, try something else.
Excellent. Lovely. That brings us to my last question for you. And this is what we do on this episode. If you were to leave one question for the next guest, what would that be?
I would ask the next guest, with the fast pace of AI and how it's developing, what is the single most important skill they think students will need to retain for the workplace?
Wow, that's a fantastic question. And I can't wait to listen to the next guest on what their response will be on that. Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Asim.
Thank you.
To our listeners, do you think it's time to revitalize the traditional assessment methods? Share your thoughts at www.d2dpodcast.com or connect with us on all social media platforms at D2Disrupt. Your ideas will help us shape the next conversation. Until next time, stay curious, stay disruptive.